Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hey, Robert. Have you seen all these cute Jason Voorhees dolls and cartoons and fan art all over the internet? Of course you have.
I've at least seen some of it, but I know you shared with me an image of a Jason plush doll, and I had not encountered that specific cute horror before.
Yeah. So he's got the machete, and there's blood on the machete, but he's adorable.
But he has blood on it, like, you know, yeah. Murder weapons. I mean, even if we didn't know who he is, the context here is that this is a killer.
Yeah, he's got a huge head, huge low-set eyes. He just looks so sweet. Little stumpy limbs. He's like a little cute baby Jason. And there are cute Freddy Kruegers in the same way, cute Freddy Krueger cartoons, dolls, toys, things all over the internet. And you've seen the cute vampires, the cute werewolves, cute versions of the girl from The Ring. I looked it up. That exists. Cute predators from the movie Predator. I saw that. That's
really?
That's kind of easy because the predator already has a sort of baby-shaped head. You just make the eyes bigger. There are cute xenomorphs. You'd think that'd be difficult to do, but they're all over the internet. What is with this epidemic of monsters originally imagined to be horrifying, threatening, to haunt our dreams, to chase us through our nightmares, to murder us and our friends, and instead we're making all these versions of them that are adorable with infantile characteristics that you just want to hug and snuggle?
It seems inevitable, doesn't it? Even in weird cases like, for instance, the Babadook.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a child-murdering monster, right?
Yeah.
And then the same with Pennywise the Clown. Like, you would think that Pennywise, this thing that appears as a clown in order to, you know, drain the essence out of children and pull them into – horrify them and pull them into sewers, you would think that would be beyond our ability to make cute. And yet just the other day I was looking at cute pins of Pennywise all cuted up.
Yeah, well, if you want to go in the cosmic direction, how about all the cute Illithid or the cute, you know, Cthulhu mythos stuff?
Yeah, when
cute plush Cthulhus.
When my son came into my life, that was one of the first things we gave him was a plush Cthulhu, which he loves, and it's an adorable looking creature. But yeah, he doesn't even know that it is essentially supposed to be a scary monster.
I guess it's not funny to children in the same way it is funny to adults.
No, he just sees it as a cool pretend little creature. It's like if you encountered Snuffleupagus and then somebody said, oh, yeah, Snuffleupagus is actually patterned after this hideous monster.
Right, this thing that snorts you up as a liquid through its trunk.
Yeah.
Though I do want to say, before this epidemic of cute cartoon versions and cute dolls and stuff like that of, say, Freddy Krueger, there is a precedent for this within the horror media itself, because you've seen the Freddy Krueger movies, right? The Nightmare on Elm Street movies.
Yeah, right. I've seen the first one, and I've seen the remake. And I like both of those. And then the rest is just mostly clips and just the pop cultural absorption of this ever ridiculous Freddy Krueger that that has all these catchphrases and ingenious kills.
Yeah.
That all just kind of blurs together for me.
Well, there is definitely an arc throughout the series where over time, the Freddy Krueger of the first movie, in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, I think Wes Craven went out of his way to make him not just a threatening monster, the standard kind of monster that will hurt you and chases you, but to make him repulsive and really just nasty. I mean, Freddy Krueger in the first movie is a character who's supposed to be a child murderer, and there are these suggestions of perversity and this kind of gross creepiness, not just threatening monstrosity. And so from that point, I think it's really amazing that over the arc of the series, Freddy becomes sort of almost something like an anti-hero. Like he's never actually a good guy, but he stops becoming this gross creep that you don't even want to look at and becomes this jokester who dances and mugs for the camera and has one-liners, makes jokes, and he becomes the star of the films. He becomes the reason people watch it, and it's because he's fun and he's comic.
He becomes the Crypt Keeper. He becomes Hulk Hogan. And then certainly by Jason versus Freddy, you're probably rooting for one or the other. He is – like there's kind of a 50-50 split there that you may be backing this character in the brawl.
Yeah, and maybe you could chalk that up in the Freddy movies just to the actor who played him, Robert Englund, being a great and likable actor despite the fact that he's saddled with this incredibly repulsive role. Maybe Robert Englund just bleeds through so much that you want to make him more and more likable.
Well, yeah, it even got to the point when the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street came out. A lot of people didn't like it. I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fine horror film.
I didn't like it.
You didn't like it? Well, no. I enjoyed it. But then again, I'm less attached to the series. But one of the criticisms that I saw leveled at it was, how could you make Freddy a pedophile? How could you make make this creepiness in his character so overt? As if that like ruined a hero and not just made a grotesque monster a little creepier.
I think it was always kind of implicitly suggested back in the first movie. I mean, they never said that outright that I recall, but it's always there in the fact that, like we were saying, he's not just a threat, he's a creep, he's perverse.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting to see how people responded to kind of a doubling down on the grotesque monstrosity of the character and away from the, you know, ridiculous pop culture version of the character.
Right. Yeah. The version in the remake is not going to be doing, I don't know, Domino's Pizza commercials or whatever Freddy was doing in the 80s.
Yeah.
But of course, Freddy Krueger and the Nightmare on Elm Street series is not the only series where we see a monstrous, horrifying character transformed over time into something that's more approachable, more likable, more identifiable, maybe even kind of snuggly. This happens a lot in horror literature and even in horror folklore.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely going to get into some examples from folklore and legend, particularly some examples from Japanese folklore. Because as we're we inevitably talk about both monsters and the world of cute. Like, you have to go to Japan because Japan is the home not only of some pretty hideous folkloric monsters, but also kawaii. This notion of like overt, just overpowered cuteness, the Hello Kitty level of cuteness that has not only taken Japan by storm, but has spread its cuddly tentacles into just about every portion of the Earth.
Yeah, it's like overclocking the adorability processor.
Yeah, almost to the point of insanity. And I should also point out that this also goes the other way, of course. Just as monsters often become cute, there are also plenty of examples of people taking something cute and making it monstrous. I kind of did it just a few minutes ago talking about Snuffleupagus, but you inevitably see people who say do a Lovecraftian take on Totoro, and then there's a whole area of kawaii known as kawaii noir, which is like dark cute, where they have something that pretty much intentionally has a leg or maybe a tentacle in both the cute and the monstrous content bucket.
I feel like this is something that very often happens in comedy animation. I think, you know, shows like South Park and Futurama and Simpsons and stuff like that always have a scene at some point where a very cute animal turns out to be a horrifying killer.
Yeah. So in today's episode, we're going to explore this. We're going to explore what is the relationship between the monstrous and the cute? Why is there this interesting interplay? And in doing that, we're going to, of course, discuss a little bit about what a monster is, though I think we've hit that harder in previous episodes here of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We're going to talk about what it is to be cute, what's going on when something cute hijacks our brain. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to look to really three specific examples of Japanese monsters that may or may not be transformed into something cute. We'll be discussing the Oni, the Kappa, and the Tengu.
All right, Robert, what is a monster?
Oh, well, you know, it's like cute. It's like pornography. We know it when we see it.
Right.
But if you really have to, you know, if you really force somebody to define it, what you tend to think about something that is awesome in form or size. It's novel and its chimerical combination of natural forms, you know, like it's got the head of a seahorse and the body of a cow. That's a monster. Or it's just a giant seahorse. A seahorse the size of a school bus would also be a monster.
I subscribe to the Metallica theory of monsterdom, which is that a monster is the thing that should not be.
Yes.
It's a thing that you behold and realize that it is not only not something you recognize from nature, but it's something that you do not wish nature had. Now, obviously, we violate those norms all the time because we get into monsters. We find ourselves at home thinking about monsters, and we kind of do wish there was a giant mummy crocodile with laser eyes.
Right.
But at least in theory, the thing a monster is it violates natural categories in some way, and it horrifies you, makes you afraid, makes you not want it to be there.
And as we discussed in our episode, The First Monster, which came out previously for this year's Halloween, there's often a message there. If not a message that is tied up in the monster's form, then tied up in the monster's presence or in the stories about it. Like, this monster is a danger to you because of why? Because you went somewhere or you did something, or you're engaged in a culture that went somewhere or did something.
Yeah, rarely do monsters appear in folklore without some kind of warning or social message.
Right. Okay, so that's monsters in a nutshell. But how about cute? Cute is in a way easier to nail down, but also just as ambiguous as monstrosity.
Well, it's one of those things that everybody can identify it by sight. You know, you can tell, well, that's cute, that's not, that's cute, that's not. But when you're asked to give a set of criteria for how you're making the decision, you'd often come up at a loss for words, right?
Well, it's certainly in the eyes of the beholder, but we can tease it apart to a certain extent. We can say, look at almost universal images of the cute and see what's connecting with us there and then figure out why it's connecting with us. So, for instance, kittens, babies, or, of course, Hello Kitty, which is essentially a kitten combined with a baby or a small child.
With psychedelic color schemes.
Psychedelic color schemes. And then, of course, many cute creatures of either real ones or fanciful ones. What do they have? They have big, adorable eyes or perhaps big jowls, baby-like cheeks.
They're kind of Winston Churchill's.
Yeah.
No. there do appear to be some biological roots to our recognition of cuteness. It does seem to go into our mammalian brains and not just into cultural categories, though culture may very well inform a lot of what we find cute downstream of these biological cues. So in his 1872 book, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, Charles Darwin suggested that Natural selection is probably going to favor creatures which, in infancy, possess features that cause the adults of that species to protect them and take care of their needs, right? If you are a species that has a genome that says we usually give birth to babies we find repulsive and don't want anything to do with, mm-hmm. that species isn't going to do very well.
Right, or at least you're going to have a situation like the Komodo dragon, where the young of the Komodo dragon, they pretty much, they're on their own.
Right.
And they have to protect themselves from such threats as adult Komodo dragons.
Exactly. So this would be in species that need to spend a lot of time protecting and caring mm-hmm. for their young. This is something we see in mammals, right?
Right.
And other species, but especially in mammals. So a lot of Darwin's book deals with things like the screams of infants and how the scream of an infant elicits parental attention. But usually if an object is screaming at you, don't you just find it annoying? Like you want to get away from it? Like if there's just an orb in a room screaming at you, I wouldn't want to care for it. I would run away.
Correct. Yeah. If a human on a train is screaming, you want to find out what's happening. You might even want to help. Mm-hmm. But there's at least that question mark phase of the screaming.
Right.
What is going on here? Let me find out so that I can act accordingly.
Yeah, it's attention getting. But the demands of an infant have to be more than simply attention getting. To be adaptive, they have to be sharpened to appeal to specific vulnerabilities in the adult caregiver's brain, like vulnerabilities that soften anger responses and encourage protectiveness and encourage generosity and sharing of resources and so forth. So something about the infant version of an animal has to convince the adult version of that animal to feel an attachment and to make sacrifices on behalf of this little creature. Now, we'll talk about this more in a second, but in some species, these appeals for parenting could be straightforwardly chemical, right? Pheromones and scent mm-hmm. would be examples. But couldn't these biological appeals also be visual?
It makes sense, right? That's one of the most immediate ways to interact with an object or a being is you see them and then you respond.
Right. So in the middle of the 20th century, the Austrian ethologist Konrad Lorenz, who I guess we should maybe acknowledge, it's always weird, like, should you bring this up or not? He was also a Nazi after World War II repudiated his views. I'm not aware that his ideology played any role in coming up with this schema we're about to talk about, but I guess it's worth acknowledging.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's always worth noting when a scientist has that in their background, because in some cases you definitely have science that was skewed or compromised by its association with the Third Reich. You have to at least acknowledge that it was there in order to then determine if it was a factor.
Yeah, I mean, like you had people doing science that was ideologically determined, not very objective. But I don't think that's necessarily the case in this case. So Lorenz plunged into this field by observing animal species and coming up with what's known as the Kinchin schema or the baby schema. It's a list of features that he believed were sculpted in order to trigger or release caregiving behaviors in adult animals. And he gave about 7 criteria. So let me know what you think about these, Robert.
Okay.
A large head.
Okay. Yeah. Babies have big heads.
Predominance of the brain capsules. That's going to mean not just a large head, but sort of the large forehead, like the swelling of the upper part of the head.
Mm-hmm.
Large and low-lying eyes. A bulging cheek region. There's the Churchill jowls we were talking about.
Yeah.
Short and thick extremities.
Okay.
A springy or elastic consistency.
Yeah, when you poke them.
Yeah. And a soft body. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's your plush doll. And finally, clumsy movements.
Yes, the toddling of the toddler.
Right. And subsequent studies have found evidence to partially support Lorenz's schema. So this is one reason to think that, even if he's got some kind of crazy ideology, there might be something to this because subsequent studies seem to find some of the same stuff is true. So I'll mention one study from 2009 published in Ethology by Melanie Glocker et al. And this is called Baby Schema in Infant Faces Induces Cuteness Perception and Motivation for Caretaking in Adults. And what they did in this study was they used real photos of infants digitally manipulated to accentuate or to downplay some of the features that are in line with Lorenz's criteria. And so among a group of undergraduates, the study found that the faces manipulated toward the criteria, so meaning they manipulated them to have larger eyes or a rounder face or a higher forehead, were judged to be cuter and elicited greater motivation for caregiving. People said they were more likely to give care to these more baby schema faces than the ones where they really downplayed those criteria, giving them smaller eyes, smaller foreheads, a narrower face and stuff like that.
Huh.
I've got a picture here.
Yeah, I'm looking at this right now. So basically we have an array of six images, three per row. So we have this grid of baby heads here that we're looking at, and the idea that there's a change in like cuteness from left to right.
Yeah, so you've got like normal baby heads in the middle, and then on the right you've got ultra babified baby faces,
right?
With like these gigantic eyes, really round faces, really sort of low faces with large foreheads, big brain capsules, and then on the right you've got unbabified baby faces that look sort of more like the kid in The Omen, or they look more adult, basically. Don't
they look more like old men, you know. They're kind of in that category of like the older baby, babies that where you look at them and you cringe a little bit before you tell the parents that it's a beautiful baby.
Yeah, and they tend to have like smaller eyes, a smaller forehead, a narrower head, and a less rounding of the skull. They look like weird adults rather than babies.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting to look at this and think of it in light of our basically our evolved reaction to these faces. I was looking at a study that said that scientists have used magnetoencephalography to observe a seventh of a second response time in adults to unfamiliar infant faces, but of course not adult faces. And that difference is going to be manifest in this array of faces as well. Like the cuter the baby, the more immediate your response to it, I imagine.
So, like, you see this cute baby face with the highly babified features, and you're like, whoa, I need to pay attention to that.
Yeah, I've got to look at that, and if it needs something, I guess I will go buy it some milk or some pudding or whatever it is babies eat.
Right. Put zip ties on all my cabinets, those horrible plastic things, and all my wall plugs.
I know. I'm still trying to work through all the baby-proofing on my house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's still some annoying baby-proofing that I haven't quite, like, broken by forcing a drawer open.
But so one of the interesting things about the recognition of cuteness and its biological function is that it appears to work not just within species. Now, I can't see any real reason that you would evolve to have a caregiving preference for animals other than your own species. So it might be one of those things that's just a byproduct of something that's highly adaptable.
Yeah, I mean, we're related to all these other mammalian creatures.
Yeah.
And they all have the basically the same survival techniques in place in terms of parental care for the infant.
Yeah, and it's kind of obvious from our experiences with kittens and puppies and so forth. But experiments do confirm that our appreciation for cuteness goes beyond the infant Homo sapiens. One example is a study I found by Anthony Little from 2012, published again in Ethology, called Manipulation of Infant-Like Traits Affects Perceived Cuteness of Infant, Adult, and Cat Faces. So it found that among images of three types of faces, babies, adults, and cats, first of all, people found the babies and the cats cuter than adults.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, when the faces from all three categories were manipulated to have baby schema characteristics, for example, decreasing the jaw size and increasing the forehead height, people found them cuter. And this worked for adult faces, for human baby faces, and for cat faces.
Okay, so getting into kind of the Betty Boop area there. Of like the weird like infantile but you know, arguably attractive adult female.
Yeah, it's just seeming to imply that we have the same kind of caregiving response or cuteness response to faces of all different types of creatures, no matter what age and no matter what species even. If there's a face and you make these certain types of changes to the face, we think it's cute usually, and we respond with awe, you know, zip tie the chemical cabinet.
You know, it's interesting to think of it in terms of survival adaptations for non-human animals. When you think of domesticated animals, cats and dogs, because certainly I think that I've certainly read some studies that argue for the the cat's ability to essentially hijack us by making us think it's a baby on some level.
Yeah.
You know, and I think dogs do that too to a large extent, certainly with puppies. So I could see it as a situation where an infant dog or cat that is either found or it's obtained when the parents are killed, like suddenly those are less likely to be then killed and eaten or skinned or left for dead by the humans who have found it if it hits those same triggers, you know? Now, another study I came across is a 2012 Japanese study published in PLOS One, and they tested the effect of viewing kawaii images or cute images on attentiveness. And they found that individuals who viewed infant animal images performed tasks better than those who viewed adult animals.
What?
Yeah.
That seems weird.
Like, so just if you had to have a calendar at your desk, have the baby animals calendar as opposed to the grown-up animals calendar.
Huh. I don't know. I feel unfairly skeptical of that result. Has that been replicated?
let's see. So it's not just a matter, according to this study, of cute things making us happier or amusing us. They also allegedly improve performance in, quote, tasks that require behavioral carefulness.
Oh, yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
So it's not so much – there's not a magical effect going on here. It's the idea that the cute visible stimuli may actually narrow the breadth of attentional focus.
I can see that. No, like that seeing a baby face would put the mind into a don't drop the baby gear.
Exactly. And then you take that gear and you apply it to working in your spreadsheet.
I can see that. Yeah, okay. I understand the mechanism now.
Now, different studies have also looked at the effects of cute marketing on consumer restraint, of course. Also on whether it has to what extent it affects indulgent behavior. Because the whole don't drop the baby mentality, do you want your consumer using that kind of mentality when they're potentially buying your product?
Right. You want to encourage them to drop the wallet.
Yeah. They found that for some people, cute images with big eyes or baby cheeks seem to induce more careful or restrained behavior. But again, not every case. But it's an interesting additional study related to this whole idea of intensified attentiveness.
Yeah.
Now, it's also worth noting that when we're talking about cute, we're inevitably talking about visual stimuli a lot here, because that's going to be the thing that's bound up in either a plush doll of a horror monster or a Halloween costume that's derived from it.
Yeah. Now, there are obviously also cute sounds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The cute baby sound, but even the cute baby smell. I hadn't really thought about this, but, you know, obviously if you've ever smelled a baby, it's fabulous, and it's hard to really put a finger on what's happening there. Like, why is this an attractive smell to smell a baby's head?
I'm sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Really? Well, the next time you're around a baby, do yourself a favor, smell its
sounds
head.
Sounds creepy, unless it's your baby. Maybe.
Well, no, you can just you can ask. You can say, "Hey, I've been reading
the park. And
I've been reading some studies, and in the name of science, would you allow me to smell your baby's head?"
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Have you seen that product on the market that is like a bottled cat head smell?
No, like an actual cat's head or a cat head biscuit?
I think I don't know. What is a cat head biscuit?
It's just a big old biscuit that's roughly the size of a cat's head. I'm not sure what region that is found in. I guess somewhere in the south here.
I think it's actually supposed to be a cat's head.
Oh, okay.
It's like a perfume you can buy that's supposed to smell like a cat head.
But cats don't really smell like anything unless it's a dirty cat. Like, they tend to have, like, maybe they smell like pennies a little bit or like batteries. But that's about the extent of it.
Don't they usually smell like sulfur?
Well, not the ones I'm hanging
Brimstone.
Out with. All right. Well, so on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we will get more into this conflict, this battle between cute and monstrosity.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, so we're back. So we've talked about cute, we've talked about monsters, we've talked about them mostly as distant islands, you know, entirely separate from each other. So on one hand, you have the Isle of Misfit Toys, and then you have Monster Island on the other, I suppose.
Wait, are the Misfit Toys not also monsters?
Well, yeah, I guess they're kind of monstrous. What would be the cute island?
Oh, it's that island in Japan that's got all the cats on it. Cat Heaven Island.
There you go. That'll work. So it's the difference between Cat Heaven Island and Monster Island. But you have to wonder, are these two states all that different? Are they really two separate things, or are they different points on a spectrum? Well, I ran across a really thought-provoking paper titled Monstrous/Cute, Notes on the Ambivalent Nature of Cuteness. And this is by social scientist Maja Brozozowska-Brenchinska. I hope I pronounced that at least halfway right. But I will try and link to this paper on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com so you can see it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Maja Bibi, as I will refer to her, she dives into all of this, noting that there's a certain ambiguity and hybridity to both monsters and cute entities,
Cuties. So yeah. They're not just different things, but they're something lying along the same scale, maybe?
Yeah, you can think of them as both of them as exaggerated states. And she also points out that cute images boast safe aesthetics that indicate harmless ethics.
Hmm.
So I think it's perplexing because infants, I think we can all agree, are wholly blameless creatures. I'm not saying you can't look at one in horror or fear, but that horror or fear is generally tied to the ethical nature of the creature itself.
You mean not tied?
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's generally not tied to the ethical nature of the creature itself. It's tied to, you know, your – maybe it's tied to feelings of commitment or – you know, uncertainty about the state of the world, or yeah. I guess the closest you could come to having an absolute authentic horror to the creature of the infant is to just be appalled at what it does in its diaper, you know?
Yeah.
But
well, you could also have some kind of doctrine, I don't know, some original sin type thing.
Well, yes. But that's – you're cheating at that point, I think. You're creating
right.
a narrative that actually shames an infant, and so shame on you for doing it. And you, of course, you might have some sort of response to just sort of the chaotic nature of infants. But if infants are chaotic, and they certainly can be, they're definitely chaotic neutral, if not chaotic good. They're not chaotic evil.
Okay, you've convinced me infants are okay, Robert.
Now, likewise, the monster is traditionally a thing as rotten on the inside as it is on the outside. The monster with a heart of gold is an exception, granted a pretty widespread exception at this point, but it's an exception that proves the rule.
Well, it's kind of like those the exception that proves the rule on the other side would be those evil baby movies.
Exactly,
where there's like
yeah.
a possessed demon infant or something.
Yeah, but generally, like a monster is as evil as it is ugly, and a cute baby or cartoon character is as sweet as it is visually cute.
Now, I like this, this idea of cuteness being not just a thing that we respond to as caregivers and that makes us want to give up our protection and resources for it, but it's also something that signals harmlessness. Because it makes me think about the human domestication of animals. For example, if you look at dogs, the domestic dog that we have today evolved both through natural but mostly artificial selection from some type of wolf-like canid species within the history of anatomically modern humans. Now, because humans were selecting which features to breed into their dogs, I think we often assume that cute dog breeds where the adult of the dog is very cute, were bred for cuteness simply for aesthetic reasons, right? We wanted them to look cute because we like it. But it's also worth thinking about the possibility of a correlation between cuteness and the domesticated affect itself. Like, domestic dogs seem to have been selected to retain juvenile characteristics into adulthood. And these would include things like a wider face, shorter snouts, floppy ears, a curly tail, but also positive responses to humans. This is something you would probably see in like wolf cubs or fox cubs, mm-hmm. but not in adult wolves or adult foxes. They're the juvenile characteristics of the wild ancestor or the wild cousin that are retained into adulthood in the domesticated version. And so cuteness might not only be something that releases caregiving behaviors in adults, but it's literally correlated with the biological transformation of a wild, unruly animal that cannot be contained and is somewhat dangerous into this friendly, pliable, non-threatening domestic companion. Like, the cuteness shows that it has made a biological transformation into something that won't bite you and, in fact, might want to snuggle with you.
Huh. I mean, that explains the form of the pug right down to a T.
Oh, yeah?
The pug is essentially a dog that we have bred to look as much like a human infant as possible.
Oh, yeah. It is a human baby with four legs and a tail.
That can obviously bite you, though, if provoked.
Do pugs have teeth, really?
Yes. I mean, how much more awful would it be if we'd managed to breed the teeth out of the dog? I mean, we've metaphorically bred the teeth out of the dog, but not literally.
Yeah.
All right. So that Maja Bibi paper that I was discussing earlier, she also points a lot of this out about Japanese kawaii, that the term itself, again, this is the Japanese cuteness or hyper-cuteness. Kawaii derives from the word kawayushi, which principally means shy and embarrassed as well as vulnerable, small and darling. And it's applied to both babies and old people, perhaps denoting a certain helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also seen where there's a variation on kawaii, a variant word that is used as a put down, that has a negative connotation as meaning pathetic, poor, or pitiable in a generally negative way.
Oh, so it's like on the playground when a bully says the other kid is like, "Oh, little baby."
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring that up because my son is in kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
and he's still at the age where that is the ultimate put down.
Whoa.
Like, if you're going to insult somebody, you call them a baby, and it's the worst thing in the world, to the point where our cat, if our cat misbehaves, then my son will say, "Oh, baby Mochi," or even it doesn't even have to be a person or a thing. It can just be a general idea, or it can be an object, and you just put baby in front of it. And that's like the ultimate belittling of it.
Like the toaster won't work. It's a baby.
Yes. Baby toaster. Like instead of saying stupid toaster or some other more adult, word, you just say baby toaster. Ugh.
But that's funny because I think the literature reflects that children do respond well to these infantile features as well, right? Like children like the baby schema. Children like cuteness a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you just have to look at their stuffed animals and there's the proof.
Yeah.
So the idea here is perhaps the monstrous and the cute are the same energy applied in opposite directions. In fact, Maja Bibi writes of cuteness as a pendulum. It, quote, works inevitably as a sort of pendulum swinging to and fro and thus being able to play its role only up to a certain point where the sweetness becomes a mock and a pitiful or ironic alter ego of itself. And I would wonder if the same holds true of monsters as well. Because if monstrousness and cuteness, if these are essentially one slider, and, you know, think of it as like Photoshop, where you have a slider between dark and light, mm-hmm. or it's a slider for shade or tint or something. Could you push the slider so far in not only the cute direction, but the monster direction so that the monstrous thing becomes ridiculous? Now, obviously, all this is in the eye of the beholder, but I instantly thought of Rat Finks. I thought of some of the monsters from the Spawn comics, and I thought of the monsters from the wonderful 1993 movie Freaked, which are very much modeled after, I think, Rat Finks. So Rat Finks, these are like these monsters form bulging eyes, grotesque smiles and teeth that were shown, illustrated to ride a hot rod around. And they're not scary. I wouldn't say they're necessarily cute, but it's like the monstrous elements of the character design are pushed to such a degree that it's almost impossible to find it frightful anymore.
Right. It's like you almost intuitively detect excess.
Yeah.
And it becomes funny.
Yeah. And with cute, I can think of, it's one of those you know it when you see it examples, but we've all encountered sickeningly sweet, sickeningly cute, where something has been just designed so cute that it is almost repulsive.
Yeah.
And the only example I can think of offhand is that I feel like the character Gurr in Invader Zim, this is the Yonan Vasquez comic and TV series, the character of Gurr is intentionally just so cute looking that it causes revulsion.
Well, a lot of times the revulsion comes in, I think, in the addition of text or speech. Like, I think of the memes where you've got a kitten and the kitten might just be adorable on its own. But like, if you add some meme text to it, it becomes gross where the kitten says, like, you know, I made you a cookie, but I eated it.
Yes, that's like linguistically, sickeningly cute.
Yeah. Why is that? Why does that feel over the edge? It's like so cute. It's unpleasant.
I don't know why. I guess it kind of falls into the same way. Like children are, when they use grammar incorrectly, it can be cute to an almost destructive degree. Like I'm trying to remember, there's something that my son would say, and I actually hesitated to correct him because it was so adorable. And then I finally was like, I just can't do that. It's selfish of me. I need to teach the boy to speak properly, even if it means destroying these cute moments.
Was he calling like a broken toy a baby or something?
No, what was it he said? It'll come to me later, I'm sure. So Maja Bibi does not, she didn't push the slider idea specifically, but I think she would agree with it because she says, quote, "It's possible to position both cute and monstrous in one dimension, the space that Michel Foucault called heterotopia, the place outside the norm, the site of revolutionary potential to change, to pose an alternate order, where the coherence between words and reality is no more possible, and the paradox is the structuring rule."
So it's so cute, it's insane, or it's so monstrous. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that Lovecraftian vibe, like the monster is so terrifying that you just lose your entire mind. And likewise, something could be that cute that you just you can't. You just have to. It kind of gets into the whole theory about the biting of babies, like the desire to pinch a baby because it's so cute.
I know you've talked about this before, but I don't know much about it. What's the deal here?
We have an older episode. There's one I did with Julie on this topic. But it's been studied. Like basically, you see something so cute and you just want to bite it. You want to pinch it. you know, it could be a kitten or a puppy or a child. And it's really that the cute has become overpowering that it has to be counterbalanced with something awful.
Huh.
Yeah.
So you need to hand the cute puppy a blood-splattered machete like the Jason doll.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But in a way, that blood-splattered machete is the pinch. It's the counterbalance here. And I wonder if there are other examples we could look to in cute iconography where we have added a little, you know, some sort of an adult element, some, you know, violence or terror to something. And it does serve to balance it out and prevent us from going completely insane.
All right. Well, we've already looked at a bunch of monsters from, you know, modern fiction and modern horror and stuff like that. I think we should turn our attention to traditional folkloric monsters and see if they make this same transition in our popular culture and become cute over time. So let's do the case studies next from Japanese folklore. After we come back from this break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. So, obviously, the Japanese have many spirits, many demons, many monsters, just a rich assortment of yokai to choose from. But we're going to focus on what you can think of as the big three, the Kappa, the Oni, and the Tengu.
Okay.
So let's start with the Kappa. You're familiar with the Kappa, I assume.
Yeah, we both read this great paper from Asian Folklore Studies from 1998 by the scholar Michael Dillon Foster called The Metamorphosis of the Kappa, Transformation of Folklore to Folklorism in Japan. And this has – it's just replete with all these great old Kappa legends. This is a fun monster despite the fact that in its original incarnation, it was not cute. It was a nasty – creepy, gross, horrific little demon.
Yeah, it's hard to really come up with a creepier, grosser, just more nefarious monster than this. Like, in a way, it rivals what we were talking about with the original Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
Like, something that's just like a weak, evil thing that has to, in Freddy's case, prey on children in their dreams.
Yeah.
While they're sleeping. And likewise, the Kappa is essentially a drowning monster. It's a monster that serves as a warning and a signifier of the risks of swimming or swimming alone in a pond or a river,
or even walking by a river.
Yeah, the inherent danger of water,
or using a toilet. I mean, it'll get you anywhere that's wet.
Oh, it will get you too. So the Kappa, also known as Kawako, or the child of the river. Yeah, it's essentially a Japanese manifestation of drowning fears, particularly with young children. And its signature hybridity, because you're going to find this hybrid nature in any monster pretty much, and certainly in the three we're looking at here, is that it's essentially a tortoise with a monkey's head, or it's like a monkey that has scales on it as well, maybe webbed fingers. And some accounts also go in an otter direction by making it hairy.
Oh, but that'll make it cute, right?
Well, depends on the otter. Otters...
Are they not as cute as I think?
Depends on the otter. Like the giant otter, if you've ever seen like a giant, I think it's an Amazonian river otter, they look rather hellish. And if you actually study like the mating behavior of otters, like they're all pretty gross.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of violence in their mating.
Horrible.
Face chewing, that sort of thing.
Whoa.
Yeah. But in the case of the Kappa here, its other most notable feature is a small depression in the top of its skull called a sara, which contains a fluid that serves as its life force. And we'll get back to the implications of that in a second.
So if this were like a low-budget horror movie, it would be Cuphead.
I guess, yeah. So the Kappa draws people and animals into water where they devour their prey and or drink their blood or their life essence. They're also big sumo fans, so they might
try the sport of sumo.
Yes, they love sumo wrestling, and they might try and wrestle you. And there are at least 8 regional variations on the Kappa, and most of what we know of them comes from early 20th century folklorists and or amateur collectors. But if you want to avoid the Kappa, there are 3 ways. One, don't go where there are Kappas. That's a big one.
Okay.
You know, don't go near the water at all. Or you can befriend them by bringing a cucumber. And stories vary because they like cucumbers, but stories vary on whether eating a cucumber prior to swimming will attract or repel the monster.
Now, they like cucumbers, but they don't like gourds.
That's right. Gourds will repel them. And there's some interesting material in the paper here that gets into exactly like what that means, the symbolic meaning of like the phallic cucumber and an arguably yonic gourd. So it gets heavy. It's a great paper. And then finally, you can make a low bow to the Kappa, especially if it's challenging you to a sumo wrestling match, and this will force it to respond in kind, so it'll dump its own life force out onto the ground.
Oh, Cuphead is tricked.
Yeah. I think this is fascinating because this may be the only monster that can be slain through etiquette alone. Just proper Japanese etiquette, and you will defeat it.
Yeah, and this does seem to make it not quite as, you know, absolutely horrific as some other monsters. Now, there are horrific qualities to it, but the fact that you can so easily trick it and the fact that it seems bound by some standards of politeness does sort of undercut its original horror, maybe?
Yeah, a little bit. But then again, you also have to look at this and any monster and realize that it's it's not occurring in one place at one time.
Right.
There are various traditions, various versions of it. So you can easily see somebody comes along and like, this monster sounds horrible. This monster needs rules to keep it in place.
Yeah.
And these are the cultural rules that will keep the monster at bay. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, well, that kappa doesn't sound that monstrous. So it drowns or drains a few children. Well, wait for this, because Foster in his paper points out, quote, not only does the kappa have a penchant for pulling both children and adults into the water, but it often does this in order to steal the liver, a feat it achieves by reaching its arm up through the victim's anus to snatch the desired organ.
Yes, you heard that right, folks. It will steal your liver through your anus.
And to do that, it gets worse. In order to steal the liver, it has to essentially uncork the human anus by removing the non-existent organ known as a shirikodama. Quote, a ball once thought to be the mouth of the anus.
This is maybe something we should do an entire episode on someday, is all of the non-existent human organs people used to believe existed.
That would be good. Let's remember that one for later. Now you're probably wondering, well, why would they make this up? Why is there has to be a reason to make up this organ? And like, clearly you can inspect yourself and realize that there's no cork, organ in your anus. But the grim reality here is that you have a drowning victim. A drowning victim is found, and they may have a, quote, open anus due to the unclenched sphincter muscles.
Oh, I see.
And this falls in line, of course, with the kappa's role as a monster of drownings. You find this this body, and here it is. There's something peculiar about it. Its anus does not look like a living person's anus.
But wouldn't this be the case with any dead person, not just somebody who drowned?
Yeah, and that's something that that Foster brings up. However, my read on it, though, is that if you're dealing with people who have drowned, I feel like there's a higher possibility that that body is found nude or mostly nude, since it was swimming, whereas bodies in other situations may be covered with clothing and then therefore less susceptible to this kind of folkloric exploration of what is happening.
Okay, but it's not just going to pull you into the river or the lake or whatever. The kappa also haunts toilets.
That's right. It may wait until you are vulnerable while pooping or peeing, perhaps near the water, and it is ready to attack the buttocks and hips, according to Foster. So it's not only a murderous creature; it's a creature of profound sexual violence as well. It's part of its design, this kappa. That's just how monstrous it is. It's very much like the Freddy Krueger. Like, the kappa and Freddy are essentially cut from the same mold.
Right. Not just threatening, but really gross.
Right. So how do we get from this to cute, you're probably wondering. Well, as Foster explores in his paper, by the 1960s, folk belief in the creature had all but vanished, and it had become a, quote, clean, cute creature used as a symbol of tourism, of commerce, of clean water, and even as a symbol of village and national identity.
Huh.
And he says that this falls in line with Hans Moser's 1962 notion of folklorism, in which an existing folklore is taken out of context and altered or invented for a specific purpose. And, of course, media and commerce play a heavy role in this.
Now, I thought this was interesting because I wondered about this concept of folklorism. And the idea is that someone would take existing folklore and change it or invent new folklore or manipulate it, take it out of context for some kind of intentional conscious purpose.
Right.
But it makes me wonder, how is that different from the way in which bits of folklore are originally created? Like, why – it's almost as if assuming that folklore arises unconsciously out of the spirit of the people, and that when people consciously manipulate folklore, that's a different kind of thing. I sort of wonder to what extent the things we think of as folklore, the original stories, are consciously created, are they not?
Well, I mean, it comes back to the whole rules thing I said earlier, like imagining someone or multiple people coming along and tweaking an existing a legend or folklore in order to convey a point or to convey a slightly different point.
Yeah.
And then likewise, I mean, yeah, there's one example that Foster points out, and this is from the Edo period. So this was 1603 to 1868 in Japanese history. And in this case, apparently you had a doctor who used a story about a kappa as a way to promote his business. The idea being that, as is the case with a lot of these monsters, they have some sort of hidden knowledge or hidden powers that a crafty individual can trick them out of. And so this doctor learned some, I think, a bone-setting technique from the kappa, and he basically put that on his calling card. If you're going to go to the doctor, then go to Dr. Kappa Touched, and he will use his mystical abilities to heal you, which is essentially a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
So keep all that in mind. But basically what happens is, after a while, people have forgotten about the kappa. Like there's no longer any belief in it. People are not reporting sightings of the kappa. But you end up going through several waves of sort of, you know, the kappa renaissance, where people rediscover it and they start using it in new ways. And this is inevitably going to involve outsiders crafting it. That's the argument here, is that the kappa is a creature of rural areas. It is a creature of the people, of the rural people. It's essentially kind of a peasant monster. Mm-hmm. But then you're going to have people that are cut off from all of that. Essentially, you're going to have city folk come along, take the kappa myth, reinvent it, reutilize it. And then after a while, like, no one's connected to it back in the rural areas anymore. So they take it back. They take this reformed version of the kappa. And then what do they do with it?
Well, they sort of turn it into a cultural mascot.
Yeah.
Right? It makes me think of – have you ever seen the tourism materials that are sent out by the Iceland Tourism Board or whatever it is?
No.
That promote the fact that people in Iceland believe in the fairies, the hidden folk, you know, the secret other world, the hidden folk that live – or believe in elves and stuff like that. I don't know to what extent it's true that many people in Iceland literally believe the fairies are there. I know some people probably do, but I doubt it is true in a literal sense to the extent to which it's promoted. But it does seem to be a thing that is it's a rumor that's spread to bring people to Iceland for tourism, because isn't that cute? People there believe in elves or believe in hidden folk.
Yeah, forgetting, of course, the fact that belief in hidden forces often – in many cases can have pretty horrifying real-world results, but it is a sanitized version of it.
Yeah.
And Foster points out that what you have here is that you have a sanitized monster that ends up being used to promote a sanitized notion of rural life in Japan. And he says that the craziest thing is that, quote, had the kappa not been snatched up by the mechanism of folklorism, it most likely would have died or survived only as a museum relic in collections of folklore. Folklorism change, in other words, kept the monster alive.
Wow. So this conscious manipulation of the folklore is the only reason the folklore really stays prominent.
Yeah. Well, like with Freddy, we can go back to Freddy and say, yeah, you can bemoan the fact that this horrifying thing from the first film was kind of killed by this subsequent incarnation. But if Freddy –
I don't know how many people really bemoan that fact, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah. But certainly, like, that's how it survived. It grew into the shape and the size that was sustained by the culture. Freddy became the Freddy that we needed, that was essential, apparently, to modern Western living.
Right. Or maybe not the Freddy we need, but the Freddy we deserve.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so how about another monster from Japanese folklore, the Oni?
Oh, yeah.
So we read another paper about this called The Transformation of the Oni from the Frightening and Diabolical to the Cute and Sexy. And this is by a Japanese scholar named Noriko T. Ryder, also in the journal Asian Folklore Studies. And this is from 2003. So Ryder's paper is really interesting. It charts a very, very similar arc to what we talked about with the kappa, this folklore monster transforming into something that's different in modern 20th century pop culture. The Oni appear in Japanese literature and folklore going back to ancient times, and the Oni are generally these large, disgusting, shape-shifting monsters with one or more horns on the head. They wear tiger skin garments, and they like to eat human flesh. Other common powers include flight and the ability to shoot lightning, and there are sort of different breeds of Oni, right?
Yeah, there are basically two varieties. There's like the terrestrial Oni and the infernal Oni. Mm-hmm. And the infernal Oni is there to drag you to hell at the moment of your death, if you are in fact deserving of one of the hells.
Yeah, so first let's look at the old vision of the Oni before they were tamed or domesticated. let's look at their wolf-like canid ancestor. So the scholar Ishibashi Gaha argues that the Japanese Oni concept evolved from a previous type of spirit or monster, the Yomotsushi Kome, which is literally fearful creatures of the Netherland.
Ooh, I like it.
And these appear as early as the Japanese creation myth known as the Kojiki. So in the first known Japanese language dictionary compiled sometime around the year 930 CE, Oni is defined as, quote, hiding behind things, not wishing to appear. It is a spirit or soul of the dead. So in this earlier vision, it's more of a spirit. And there are these different categories of Japanese folkloric beings. There are, you know, more like the kami, you know, the deities.
Right.
And then there are the yokai, which are more like the monsters. And it was during the medieval period in Japan that the Oni became a major part of popular folklore in this classical monster form that we first introduced. Common Oni features in the medieval folklore are going to include some of what we've already described, things like one or more horns on the head, skin colors like red or blue or black or yellow, a third eye in the forehead, carrying an iron mace as a weapon, wearing a tiger skin loincloth, and the fact that they're usually male but not always. And Oni were these horrific demon monsters that people believed to exist in the world, kidnapping people, especially young women, drinking their blood, eating their flesh. But they also seemed to be this useful cultural concept. In the words of a scholar named Komatsu that Ryder cites in her paper, many Oni were, quote, people who had different customs or lived beyond the reach of the emperor's control. Hmm. And you can see this in the way that Oni were deployed in Japanese imperial propaganda during World War II, which was depicting enemies of the state such as Winston Churchill or FDR or the Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek as Oni. And it's common, of course, during war to motivate your populace against the enemy by characterizing them as devils of some sort.
Oh, yeah. We see plenty of examples of that in Western countries as well during the same time period.
Absolutely, yeah. But apparently this cultural inclusion and exclusion tactic follows the Oni monster specifically deep into history. So a few stories about the Oni. One story appears in the 10th century CE narrative Tales of the Issei, and it goes like this. You got a man. And he falls in love with a woman of high social status, mm-hmm. and he kidnaps her. And they are fleeing in the night, and there's a thunderstorm. So the man decides they should take shelter at a ruined building near the Akuta River. And the woman goes inside the building for shelter, and the man stands guard at the door all night. But when the woman is alone inside, an Oni appears, and it eats her in a single bite.
Oh, man.
That's got to be a big Oni, right?
Yeah.
She screams when the Oni's there eating her, but the man standing guard doesn't hear her because of the thunder. And this portrays this sort of alliance between the Oni and these powerful elemental forces like lightning storms. Oni are sometimes said to be able to shoot lightning. Now, another story is contained in a 9th century collection called the Nihon Ryuiki, and the story translates to, "On a woman devoured by an Oni." So at the time the Emperor Shomu reigned, a rich family in Yamato province had this beautiful daughter. And lots of men wanted to marry her, but she was like, nah, not interested. Until a suitor shows up with unbelievably extravagant gifts to win her over, including 3 carriages full of silk. So she accepts his marriage proposal, and on the wedding night, the newlyweds stay in the house of the bride's parents. The woman's parents hear her crying out in pain during the night, but they don't do anything about it. And when her mother enters the bride and the groom's bedroom in the morning, all that's left is her daughter's head and a single finger.
Oh.
And the rest has been eaten by a shape-shifting Oni, which apparently appeared in the form of a handsome young man. And this is evidence early on that the Oni have this power of shape-shifting, one of the most common things. Like very often in other stories, Oni would appear as beautiful women in order to seduce men, and then they would turn into Oni and try to devour them or kill them or something.
Someone should do a version of the werewolf game with Oni. They're perfect for it, you know?
That would be perfect. Yeah. Oni, yeah. There are Oni among us. Okay. So how do the Oni become cute?
Yeah, because it's like with the Kappa, this sounds pretty monstrous and horrific. This is like a standard, like, woman-eating ogre here. How does it become a cute thing?
Well, Ryder cites several examples of how Oni have become cute in modern Japan on a very similar time scale to what we talked about with the Kappa. You know, mm-hmm. the Kappa especially having these cute incarnations in the second half of the 20th century, especially around the 1970s. One example of cute Oni that Ryder cites is the Loom Invader. So in 1978, the Japanese manga artist Rumiko Takahashi created this incredibly popular series called Urusei Yatsura, which translates literally into something like those obnoxious aliens. And beginning in the 1980s, it was adapted into a TV series, films, and a bunch of other spin-off media. And the premise is that there's a group of Oni from outer space that arrive on Earth, sort of blending Oni folklore with these alien invasion stories that started to become popular in the middle of the 20th century. Uh-huh. And one of these invaders is an Oni called Loom, who at first is part of this invasion force, but somehow she ends up becoming the loving and devoted wife of a lecherous teenage boy on Earth. Unlike the Oni from medieval folklore, Loom is not overtly monstrous. Instead, she's represented primarily as cute and through overtly eroticized characteristics. In short, she's depicted as she's supposed to be sexy. And Loom has these subtle signs pointing toward the traditional Oni. For example, Oni usually have horns. Loom has these couple of diminutive horns on top of her head. She sometimes seems to have fangs and other indications of a cannibalistic nature. She seems to have the power to shoot lightning, which is associated with some Oni legend. She can fly, like the Oni. And Oni are often depicted, I mentioned earlier, as males wearing a tiger skin loincloth. Loom wears a tiger skin bikini.
Huh.
I was talking with our coworker, Lauren Vogelbaum, one of the hosts of Food Stuff, another podcast in the How Stuff Works Network you should check out if you enjoy food and all things edible and imbibable. But I was talking to her about this because I know she is an insightful consumer of manga. And she pointed out that there are actually plenty of other anime and manga characters that display this trend of taking a traditional monster and making it cute or making it sexy or both. And one example she mentioned was a manga series known as Sayuki, in which the main characters are the Monkey King character and his demon companions, but they are rendered as cute boys. These are these like attractive young men, sort of like an manga boy band.
Uh-huh.
But a demonic one, and they are essentially a male parallel to the cute and sexualized Oni we see in Loom.
But as with the Kappa, all of this with the Oni comes down to like the revitalization of rural areas, right?
Oh, well, that's another aspect of it too. Yeah, mm-hmm. So you've got this stuff in mass media, but then you've also got, like we saw with the Kappa, being used as some kind of a rural mascot for a town or a village. The town revitalization movement is another thing that Ryder points out as a place that the Oni re-enter the modern consciousness and kind of metamorphose into something much sweeter. So there's this movement, the town revitalization movement. In Japanese, I think it's Maki Okashi. And so in the same way that the Kappa was embraced as a local mascot, it seems the Oni have been as well. And Ryder cites these examples, the Oemachi in Kyoto, which is located near Mount Oe. This is the traditional setting of a story called the Shuten Doji, which is about this band of Oni that live in the mountains and they're doing their Oni thing. You know, they're kidnapping and eating locals, especially local maidens, and they'll mm-hmm. eat their flesh and drink their blood until some warriors infiltrate the Oni hideout and kill all the Oni. And Ryder writes that at the time of this paper, this town with the original setting near the Shuten Doji, the town is facing a depopulation crisis, with the population essentially growing old and younger people not replacing them. And one way the residents apparently sought to revitalize the town was to embrace the Oni legend and the imagery in order to attract interest and tourists. So they developed these Oni-related legends and sites. They got an Oni museum. So a creature that would have once caused unspeakable terror is now this fun attraction to draw people and money.
It's kind of like the small town kid makes good. He leaves the small town, makes it big, and then is just invited back in and becomes a hero, even though they kind of treated him like dirt to begin with.
Yeah. Well, it also sort of reminds me of what you might see in, say, Salem, Massachusetts, where mm-hmm. originally you had the fear of witchcraft, which yeah. was a genuine panic that terrified people and led to deaths. And now it's more to – it's embraced in this kitschy way. Like, witches have become a cute part of Salem's identity as a town. So they'll have witch museums and witch souvenirs and stuff like that.
Despite the horrifying reality, the essential like human monstrosity of the whole situation.
Exactly.
So what can we take away from this example?
Well, Ryder's got some ideas. So we've got these two different things I mentioned, the cute, non-threatening, and eroticized oni that appear in Japanese cartoons, and the embracing of oni folklore as an economic and tourism draw. And Ryder writes that much of the art and entertainment in Japan still views the oni as evil and terrifying beings. Like, it's not all cute oni now. She gives the example of the 1990 film Dreams by Kurosawa.
I've seen that one, yeah.
And one of the stories in this movie apparently tells the story of humans who were turned into oni by a nuclear blast.
Oh, man. I vaguely remember that. I mainly remember the space section of it.
Yeah.
Not so much the oni. I'll have to go back and watch it.
It's a horrifying idea.
Yeah.
But now we also have these oni with inherent aspects of harmlessness, cuteness, the eroticized aspects. They're the ones that are simply fun and familiar, like the witches now. And she seems to think that this is an outgrowth of Japan's post-war economic transformation. In other words, horrifying folk beliefs in monsters don't really make you the big bucks, but apparently cute, harmless, fun, and familiar monsters can bring massive economic dividends. Capitalistic folklorism, in the sense that we explored in that previous paper, folklorism, mm-hmm. the manipulation of folklore, seems to be directly at work in Ryder's point of view.
Huh.
But it also sort of makes me wonder, why monsters in the first place? Like, if it's simply that cute, harmless, or sexy characters and imagery command more economic power, why isn't it just that we're seeing new characters of this type created? Like, why are traditionally horrifying and disgusting monsters being transformed into these cute or sexy or otherwise harmless versions?
Well, I wonder if part of it is that there is, perhaps even subconsciously, it's an interaction with a monstrous figure that had power over us and maybe still has power over us, and by making it cute you're making it harmless, you're taking the punch out of this monstrous creature, it's like laughing in the face of horror.
Well, it almost makes me wonder if this transformation is an outgrowth of the skepticism and secularization of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as people tend to believe less literally in demons, monsters, and devils, would we tend to take them less seriously as genuine threats? I mean, obviously we would. And if we think that there's no genuine monster danger to warn against, what prevents us from stripping the fear-inducing elements out of the monster folklore? Is it a thing we do simply because we can? Does that make sense? Like, if in the past people didn't make the monsters harmless because they believed that you genuinely had to understand that these monsters were dangerous, as soon as we stopped taking monster legends literally, mm-hmm. then we had the power to render them, to defang them.
Yeah, I think I would buy that. That sounds like a good read on it, yeah.
But there's another thing that I wonder about is, like, could it represent an actual direct rebuke of the past, kind of a middle finger to
yeah.
the superstition that produced belief in monsters throughout, you know, every culture in the history of humanity?
Yeah, I mean, it's because we've touched on this a number of times when we've talked about older ideas, mythologies, religion even, where it's easy to take a modern approach and say, oh, well, those people were stupid. Look at the things they believed in. Monsters in the woods eating you, some sort of strange
right.
turtle creature reaching up your anus after your liver. But when you begin to dissect these ideas and you put them in the context of the time,
right.
It's not so simple as to just say, oh, well, these people were dumb.
No, they weren't stupid. They knew less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the same thing.
Right. I mean, in a way, they perhaps knew more because they knew to take, a dangerous area or a dangerous, cultural area
yeah.
and assign a monster to it to ward people away from it, to keep the curious from getting too close.
Right.
And
children don't go near the water's edge because
exactly.
there's a monster there.
Yeah. And even if you're not up on the reasons to stay away from the water, like the realistic reasons, the monster still resonates. And we've actually touched on this on the podcast in regard to creating, potentially creating new monsters, new mythologies to guard, say, places where radioactive waste are deposited.
Right. So you've got high-level waste, you know, the really dangerous stuff stored at a place somewhere on Earth, and that's going to be dangerous for literally thousands of years, much longer than any kind of sign you would probably put up would be there.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, if you made a really durable sign. But, yeah, it's going to outlast almost any measures you put in place to keep people away. So it's almost like you wish you could come up with a lasting cultural belief that this place is cursed and there's a monster that dwells there and there's nothing of value and a sticky image that will drive people away for hundreds of generations.
Yeah, and that's exactly what a monster is. Nations fall, empires fall, laws fade, signs of warning fall into the dust, but the monster perseveres.
Yeah, and so coming back to how we make the monsters cute, I'm wondering if it's this secular rebuke. Like, is turning a monster cute an attempt to say, even unconsciously, maybe not like people do this on purpose, but are they at some level saying there are no demons, devils, or monsters, and I'll show you? And they do it by making the image cute. Is it like sort of the equivalent of blasphemy, but instead of against the gods, it's against the monster belief?
Yeah. And of course, it's dangerous to rebuke the monster because no matter how silly you think it is, no matter how two-dimensional the monster might seem, there's probably a lot more going on there than meets the eyes.
Totally. You know, I was thinking one other way to clarify what might be happening here. I don't know. Maybe this won't be any additional clarity. But are there any monsters we can think of that have not undergone this process, where there are no cute versions of them or almost no cute versions of them? There's not any pervasive attempt in the culture to make a toothless version of the creature.
Well, if we're looking at Japanese demons, I would say that the Tengu is probably an interesting case of this.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say there are no cute Tengu. You can certainly find them. I found them just doing image searches for the English word Tengu.
But you think they're less prevalent?
I'm getting somebody with more experience with Japanese culture and pop culture can maybe chime in on this. But it seems like there's less of it. You do see Tengu showing up in video games and manga and all other forms of media. But they tend to retain a certain seriousness that is lacking from, again, the kappa. You don't see kappa snatching livers out of anuses as much anymore. But in these cases, the Tengu still tends to retain a certain regal character and a certain dangerous element as well.
Yeah.
So I should probably talk about what the Tengu is, though, for anyone who's not familiar.
Hit me with it.
All right. So the Tengu, they are a warrior class of monsters who reside in the mountain forest of Mount Kurama, north of Kyoto. And their hybridity is that of a bird and a man.
Mm.
Usually they're described as having a humanoid body but with glowing eyes and a long red beak. And sometimes that beak is more depicted as a long nose. So I imagine if you've ever played a video game and there's a character that seems to have a mask with a long red nose, that's essentially a Tengu.
Huh.
So they have feathered wings, and they're warlike. They're skilled in martial arts. Humans sometimes seek them out to learn their arts but frequently go mad upon encountering them. And then, of course, they also have this mischievous side. So if you're in the mountain woods and you hear something like laughter, well, that might be the laughter of Tengu. If a tree falls, it might have been taken down by a Tengu wind.
Hmm.
And these examples are from the book by Haruko Wakabashi, The Seven Tengu Scrolls. So the thing about the Tengu is that they were, they varied in form, purpose, and even alignment. There were, in some cases, good Tengu, but for the most part, they were portrayed as, especially in medieval Japan, as being evil, vengeful, chaotic spirits. They were enemies of Buddhism. In some cases, they were fallen priests who failed to achieve nirvana. And they were the embodiment of Ma or Mara, or obstacles to Buddhist enlightenment. Now, it's worth noting that they were different from moral evil in this regard, or Aku. In this, the Tengu were, you can essentially think of them as obstructionists. they were there to just, to try and prevent you from achieving enlightenment, and you had to battle them in your life to get past them.
Huh.
So they were kind of serious business, you know?
Yeah.
And very high-minded, monstrous symbols. And I think that's key, too. Whereas these other examples were rural monsters. These were kind of the peasants' monsters. The Tengu was the thinking man's monster.
That's
interesting. And I think that plays into its survival.
Yeah. So I wonder if something about the level to which a creature is incorporated into formalized religion mm-hmm. rather than just being a part of informal folk creature or deity belief.
That's true, because there are shrines even with Tengu imagery. So
yeah.
they were more divine in many respects and, again, more regal, more a property of the ruling class and the priestly class as well. They were also tied up with explanations for a lot of serious stuff that was going on in the medieval period. A lot of the chronic social disorder and instability. They were symbols of chaos to explain the rise of the warrior class, war, and just the political disunity in what some saw as the final age of Buddha's teachings at the time. So again, it's not that you won't find cute Tengu out there, or just, you know, very pop culturally distilled images of the Tengu, but I feel like you see far less of it. The Tengu still retains a lot of its original potency.
Now, that's got me wondering about other monsters in other traditions around the world and whether the level to which they're incorporated into the formalized version of the local religion determines how likely they are to be euthanized with cuteness.
Yeah, because you look at Christianity and you don't see this. This is not the case with the devil. You see plenty of cute devils out there.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, you do. I guess that's right. I mean, I was going to say you don't see as many cute demons as you see, like, cute vampires and cute werewolves.
Yeah, maybe you have a point there. Maybe there are far more cute vampires and werewolves than there are cute demons. Or some of the more potentially problematic characters, I guess, like the angel of God. How many cute angels wrestling humans are there? And I guess you also have to ask the question, like, how many trolls are there in the culture? Like, how many
right.
how many people were willing to take even, you know, sacred cows
right.
and make them cute just for the sheer, you know, just for the giggles of doing it?
Well, then again, I mean, so I think there might be something to that sort of blasphemy equivalent. It's mm-hmm. not blasphemy against the gods, but blasphemy against the monsters, a sort of intentional rebuke and a desire to undercut their perceived power. There might be something to that, but I don't know if I really feel that when I – like if I were to draw a cute vampire, I don't know if I'd feel spiteful in doing that.
Well,
I might just feel kind of like, oh, that's funny.
You can't imagine someone going, get away from me, baby Satan. You have no power over me here. Get thee behind me, baby Satan.
So another thing I was talking to Lauren Vogelbaum about was about this question of what contributes to the transformation of terrifying monsters into these cute versions of themselves. And she made a point that I thought was really interesting. She said in the context of Japanese depictions of cute monsters mm-hmm. in manga and anime, what if it's the creeping sense of delayed adulthood and the extension of childhood that we see in a lot of cultures in the 20th century, and especially the second half of the 20th century and in the 21st century? I mean, maybe there are some cultural critics who would come back and say, this is not really a thing. This is one of those, you know, BS trend pieces. But there are a lot of people who would argue that there is a sort of creeping infantilism among adults in the Western world, especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you've heard that argument, right, Robert?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and certainly it does seem like we remain many of us remain children longer. We don't give up all of our childish things as we become adults.
So. Right. We tend to stay in school longer. We mm-hmm. get married later. All of these things that are traditionally in cultures thought of as sort of rites of passage to adulthood get like delayed later and later into life. And so it could be possible to think about the idea of the cuteness of monster imagery. Well, being related to the fact that children tend to like cute imagery. So could the transformation into cuteness represent an increasingly infantilized adult culture's attempt to make monster folklore more palatable, more cuddly for those of us who don't want to hack scariness?
Yeah, I think it could very well be the case. And, of course, it comes back to the idea, too, of cuteness and monstrosity being upon the same spectrum, being within the same dimension. And so there's this they're interconnected already anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all the more easier to begin tweaking these images and skewing their meaning.
Now, I want to be clear that I'm not necessarily endorsing the idea that adults are more infantile than they used to be. I just know that is a theory out there. I'm mm-hmm. not sure if I buy it. I remain agnostic. You know, one more thing that this makes me think about is back to our episode on euphemisms. Robert, you remember the concept of the euphemism treadmill and the dysphemism treadmill?
I do, yes.
So the euphemism treadmill is this concept. I can't remember who came up with it. Was it Steven Pinker?
I believe so. That sounds right. I'm going to say it's Steven Pinker, and I can be the one that's wrong.
Essentially, the idea is that you have a euphemism, which is a term you introduce to be a polite sort of elision word to indicate a concept that's somehow problematic or offensive or causes people, you know, like it's the nice new word that you say. But eventually, that word itself tends to become perceived in the culture as not nice. Mm-hmm. So, for example, crippled was supposed to be the nice word for people with disabilities.
Right.
And then it came to become a word that you would never want to call somebody. And so there's this process like that. But then the same thing happens the other way with dysphemisms, with words that we want to use with negative connotations. So, for example, how the word sucks, mm-hmm. you know, to say like that movie really sucked. That used to be an incredibly vulgar and offensive, just nasty thing to say. And now little kids say it. I mean, it's everywhere. It's lost its power to shock and offend.
So you have to keep inventing new words. So you're saying essentially we have to keep inventing new monsters as well. Because the old ones lose their power?
I mean, I think that could to some extent be true. Mm-hmm. Like we may be seeing some kind of equivalent of the dysphemism treadmill with the monsters of old. Over time, they're just going to lose their power to shock and offend, and they become like the little kids saying sucks, the little kids running around with cute vampire dolls.
Wow. And it's super hard nowadays with the internet because you have like probably a lag time of just hours after a film comes out before someone has made a cute button or a cute t-shirt or just a meme based on that monster.
Yeah, it happens immediately. Yeah. When there's a new movie, it happens. And I think it creates a great challenge for, say, horror movie creators to make a traditional monster scary again. Think about how many recent vampire movies you can think of that have really scary vampires. They've sort of lost their power, haven't they?
Yeah, you just can't trot out the same vampire over and over again because nobody's buying it anymore.
Right. I mean, when Bela Lugosi first showed up on screens, he had people screaming in the aisles of theaters. Mm-hmm. Now you watch it and Bela Lugosi, he's great, but he's not scary.
Yeah, we often forget just how terrifying that performance actually was and is, really, if you look at it with new eyes.
Yeah, especially if you knew that he would end up in Ed Wood movies.
That's true. That's true. All right. Well, there you have it. We have explored the monstrous. We've explored the cute. And we have explored the bridge between.
I want to know from you out there, what do you think is going on psychologically, culturally? What is happening when we take these horrifying images and creatures and make them into cute plush dolls to cuddle with?
Yeah.
Why do we keep doing it? And what effect does it have on the culture?
Yeah. What are your favorite examples of this process? And what monsters, if any, have not gone cute? And how long will they remain that way? As always, you can find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. And hey, on Facebook, we have this wonderful little discussion module you can look up. It's a group. You can join it. And you can chat with other folks who listen to the show as well as the hosts themselves. And hey, also stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes going back to the beginning of time.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly with feedback on this episode or any other, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.